Good morning, everyone. Our meeting will come to order. This is the Committee on Education Innovation Policy, and today is February 21. We are still not at quorum, but we will start our unofficial business anyway. The clerk will wait to take the roll when we have a quorum. Welcome to the 2018 session. I do look forward to working with all of you to affect policy that helps all of our students in all of our districts and charter schools. We have a couple of new staff here at the table. Casey Peterson, and I should say more than a couple because I have three new women surrounding me. Casey Peterson is our new committee administrator, and she comes to us from Rules, where she was the committee administrator previously, and before that from the Senate, where she worked for our very famed former Senator Jen Olson, and that brings a lot of expertise to our committee to have worked with such a stellar senator like Jen Olson. And Dana Peterson here, Dana Liffey, here to my left, is my new committee legislative assistant. And then we have Kelly Windsor, sitting at the table here to my left, who's our new House researcher. And also with us for a while will be Miranda Jansen from Hamline University, who's interning for our committee. And then we have the pages. Thank you, Dana. Hannah Kunish and Matthias Langley are joining us as pages, at least for today. So would you step to the microphone, Matthias, where Commissioner Caselius is sitting, and just turn it toward you, and tell us just a little bit about yourself.
My name is Matthias Langley. I'm from Albany, Minnesota. I just graduated high school last year, homeschooled. Now I'm taking a gap year, and I hope to attend North Dakota State University this fall.
Thank you, Matthias, and welcome. And Hannah, who might be related to Representative Mary Kunish Padin in some distant way.
Hannah? Good to see you. I'm Hannah Kunish. I'm from Kenyon, Minnesota. I have my two-year liberal arts degree from South Central College in Faribault. I've been bartending the last 7 years, so I wanted to try a different side of public servitude, and here I am. So thank you for having me.
Very nice. Very, very good. Before we start our official business today, I would like us to observe a moment of silence to honor the lives of the 17 students and staff who died in that heartbreaking tragedy at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida last week. We want to ask for comfort for the families and friends of those beloved, and for continued healing for those wounded physically and for all affected by that day. You know, tragedies like this affect not just a local community in which they occur, but the entire nation. So let's take a moment to honor and to remember those. Thank you. We're going to begin today with a presentation by Commissioner Brenda Caselius and her staff. And members, I want you to know that this is a commissioner and staff who have worked very hard for us. As the commissioner said to me this morning as we greeted one another, this is our eighth meeting together, whether I was the chair or the lead in this committee. Eight times is... you know, to start off a session is quite admirable that we're still here together and we're doing good work. And, you know, one of the reports the commissioner will bring us today is an update on ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, which is the federal accountability that every state has before them now as the next school year kicks off. And the department has worked extremely hard to put together the plan. even though I had some reservations about it. You know, as I said to the commissioner the other day, Betsy DeVos did not favor my suggestions to her. She continued to go the path of letting states stay in control and honored the plan that the commissioner and her staff presented. So I thought that was, you know, just really an honor to our State Department of Education. And, of course, staff underway who has worked very hard in doing a lot of the footwork that needs to be done to put together a plan that is this extensive. And these staff will introduce themselves as they present. So we're going to lead off, members, with, I believe it's the PowerPoint after the commissioner introduces herself. We're going to have this PowerPoint on ESSA and special education. And then there's going to be time for questions after staff presents. And then another item on the docket today is, excuse me, but this meeting will officially come to order. A quorum is present, and the clerk will note the roll. We also have before us today a summary booklet or document that was prepared by the department on all the reports that come to the chairs of the education committees and the leads. So Representative Mariani would have received these too, and it's quite a stack of them. But they were very gracious in summarizing these reports for all of us so that we have an idea as to what it is that usually the legislature asks the department to do, so we have this accountability. And then if there's time at the end, we will also hear House File 2737, which is a placeholder going to the general register, and perhaps a provision we'll consider in the omnibus bill as well. So welcome, Commissioner Brenda Caselius. Introduce yourself for the record, and please begin.
Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education for the state of Minnesota. I just want to say thank you, Madam Chair, for the comments about our relationship over the past 8 years. I'm pretty proud of the accomplishments that the governor and this legislature have been able to push forward for children over the past 7-plus years. And not only have we been able to fully pay back our schools, but we've also been able to make some very strategic investments, whether it's been fully Republican, fully Democratic, split, and now fully Republican again. The governor has always been interested in the best ideas for children and moving those forward. So thank you again. I'm only here briefly to introduce my team. They have done an absolute amazing job at the department, not only those represented here, but all the staff back at the department in providing service and being responsive to our schools and hopefully putting a strong focus on equity throughout the state of Minnesota to ensure every single child gets an excellent education. So I think later on when we get to budget and deeper policies and not really specific around special ed and ESSA, which will be informational today, when we get more into the policy bills, I'll give you more of a state of the state type of address and where we're at. But we had specific things that we're going to be introducing today. So I will introduce Wei Nguyen, who is our assistant commissioner. She oversees this work on ESSA, as well as Greg Keith, who is our chief academic officer, putting in place all of our regional centers and support to work. And then Stephanie Graf, all three of these people you know very well. And Stephanie is our chief accountability officer, who works with our world's best workforce, as well as our ESSA plan, and trying to do that alignment and support to schools and partners with both Wei and Greg in providing and implementing that. And so I'll come back up after they're done with the PowerPoint. If we could have them give you the summary of the PowerPoint, I'll come back up and then we'll take questions. So if you do have questions, would you please just mark those down, and then I'll come back up and I'll do what the governor says. I'll take the easy ones and give the hard ones to my team. So thanks so much for having us here today to give you an update on ESSA and special education.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome, all three of you, to the committee, and thank you again for your your work that you've done. I know Ms. Graff, and I will call you Stephanie because I feel that I know you personally, the same with Wynn and Greg. But I know that as I followed you over these many months, that you were honestly putting your best foot forward to try to come up with a good ESSA plan for the state. And that now that it's been acknowledged by the federal government, I think you can say we did our job. So welcome, and I think Assistant Commissioner Wynn, you're going to begin. So please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Wayne Nguyen. I'm an Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. The three of us will present on ESSA today. I will cover more about process, stakeholder engagement. Greg Keith will cover school improvement and implementation, and Stephanie Graff will cover the accountability system and highlight the changes that we've made to the state plan since we last met with you in the summer. So,
and members, there's a PowerPoint available with a handout. It is the long.
So again, for today's meeting, we'll cover process, timeline, stakeholder engagement, the plan approval and changes, ongoing stakeholder engagement, and the implementation of ESSA. And then our colleagues will come up later and talk about special education. So just a very high-level overview for the committee. Again, the Every Student Succeeds Act is the latest version of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, replacing No Child Left Behind. It was signed by President Obama in December of 2016?
15.
Wow. we receive roughly $250 million in federal funding for title programs. That's about 2.5% of our pre-K through 12 education spending. And it includes things like updates to requirements to data systems, reporting, accountability, and really encourage stakeholder engagement in order to put together a plan that's really reflective of the values of Minnesota. So beginning January 2016, right after the president signed the law, we engaged in almost a two-year stakeholder engagement process. We held nearly 300 statewide meetings, including committees, focus groups, Twitter town hall meetings, webinars, and surveys, community meetings throughout the state to really hear from people in Minnesota. We also met individually with every single one of the 11 tribal nations in Minnesota to really also explain ESSA and hear input from our tribal nations and their leaders about what they think is important. We also made an effort to really work with students and parents, educators, and other education advocacy groups. I do think that over the course of the last 2 years, we have built and forged really strong relationships with these groups. We may not have agreed all the time, but hopefully they will say that we listened to them, and where there were points of disagreement, I think we tried our best to explain why things were not put into the state plan. And through the stakeholder work that we did through the years, we really saw certain visions and priorities kind of rise to the top. So we really kept that in the forefront as we were writing our ESSA plan and as we, again, continue to engage with stakeholders. So some of the things that we heard from stakeholders was that they really wanted us to align ESSA and World's Best Workforce to the best that we can. There were areas in which, unfortunately, at this point, we can't align them. We will continue to work to try to align our systems as much as possible. We included things in our state plan that weren't required in our state plan to, again, try to address some of this alignment. For example, third grade reading goals was not required as part of the federal state plan, but we thought it was really important to reflect the fact that Minnesota's World's Best Workforce does have third grade reading as an accountability measure. Equity was a major focus from our stakeholders, and really, and I'll get you into the next slide, but really having a shared understanding of equity. I think there's oftentimes that word is thrown around a lot without a shared understanding of what that really means. So we spent a lot of time focusing on coming up with a definition of equity, so that we were all on the same page as we were talking about it. Well-rounded education as well was highlighted, that they wanted us to really focus on things, not just academics and not just testing. So we had great work and involvement from, for example, our FIAD teachers, our librarians, our others just saying, like, let's think about all of these other things, arts and language, make sure that we're really providing a well-rounded education to our students. And again, a real emphasis on supports to our schools, no, like Child Left Behind, was really kind of was punitive. And we at the agency have really worked to changing that, to being really much more supportive of districts, and they wanted us to continue that. And then finally, transparency and reporting. One thing I wanted to note is that there was no requirement in the state plan to really talk about a reporting system and how we are going to report the various data that's required under ESSA. We are currently doing that work right now, and we can speak to that a little bit more later in the presentation. So again, as I mentioned, we focus on equity a lot, and hopefully you see throughout the entire state plan and throughout all the materials and the way that we talk about the plan that there is a focus on equity. We worked with our committees to jointly develop the definition of education equity, so it wasn't just something that MDE developed on its own. We partnered with Voices for Racial Justice to come up with an initial definition, and then the members of the committee then helped us kind of redraft it. And then we use the same definition of equity throughout all of the committees that were formed to work on ESSA. So again, so that everybody had the same understanding and working from the same definition of equity. In addition to the definition of equity, we also had questions that really, again, we would have to kind of refocus our attention. So questions like, are the people who are affected at the table? Are we taking into consideration low-income, students of color, people from rural Minnesota, so that it's not just a definition, so that it actually really meant something? Greg can talk about this a little bit later, but we also have these 10 equity commitments that we will be working with school districts to really make sure that they're embedding in their school improvement work. And as they are talking to their school leadership teams and to their educators and to their community, certain things like prioritizing equity, starting within. And I will say that the Department of Education is also taking these commitments and looking within too, and seeing how can we commit to these commitments. So we are also looking within at MDE to say, how can we commit to equity? For example, we have hired an equity specialist, and part of this person's job is to work with staff at MDE. So making sure, again, that we at MDE have a shared understanding of equity. And then other things like starting early, engaging more deeply, so that it's not kind of just a one and done when you're engaging with stakeholders, that you really do have this feedback loop, and that you're not just bringing to them an end product, but that they're actually helping you co-create the product so that the community can really fully be invested in the plans that the districts are putting together. I'm going to hand it over to Stephanie now for kind of the changes that we made to the plan after we met with the committee in July.
Welcome, Ms. Graff. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Stephanie Graff, I'm our Chief Accountability Officer at the Minnesota Department of Education. So we were here July 19th last summer as we had we were at a place where we had kind of a preliminary draft plan that we had shared with this committee and had an opportunity to talk about where we were at in the process and the content of the plan as well. And so what I'm going to do now is actually provide some updates since when we last talked with all of you on July 19th. So while we won't be giving a full overview of our full accountability system and our whole state plan, we really wanted to provide some updates and some clarifications or some additions or some revisions revisions that have been made to the plan based on input since when we last met in July. So, again, we had our legislative hearing with all of you in July. We also had a 30-day public comment period over the course of August 2017. This was a requirement in ESSA. When we posted the plan in August, and this is what we said all along, we didn't want any surprises for stakeholders when we posted our plan for public comment, right? We had multiple opportunities throughout the process for people to weigh in and see draft language and provide feedback. But there is a requirement that we posted our plan in its entirety for 30 full days, and we did that. So I'll talk about some of the changes or clarifications that we made based on that as well. As you know, we did submit our state plan in September 18th, I believe, 2017. These are some of the buckets of sort of the areas that I'll talk about that we've made some updates or clarifications in the plan since July. One around early learning and really beefing up our early learning focus throughout the ESSA state plan. Two around, of course, accountability. I'll talk about that and then our school improvement work. And then lastly, about English learners. So these are kind of the key areas where we made some updates. We know the full ESSA state plan covers more than these four areas, right? But these are the ones that we made some updates on. So first around early learning. And as I go through each of these, I'll touch on some, and then I'll dive into a few that we heard maybe more comments on, or that we feel like you may want maybe a bit more information on. So there's quite a bit that I'll go through here, but I'll go deeper in a few key areas. So first, around early learning, we added information on support for districts in providing effective transitions for students and families between early childhood and their K-12 experience, really knowing that transition, we want it to be as seamless as possible as students move from their early childhood learning environment into their K-12 schooling. And so really focusing on providing some language around supporting districts in that seamless transition. We clarified the importance of addressing pre-K through 12 programming as part of the school improvement process. And so this was really just about being more explicit. We heard from our early learning folks the need for, if we're looking at an elementary school that is identified and receiving support, we need to look upstream, right? And so we need to really, as we're doing our needs assessment and understanding the needs and the reasons behind kind of the results that we're seeing in our accountability system, we need to look at what's happening in that pre-K environment as well. So making sure that school readiness data and early learning conversations are happening as a part of that needs assessment process through the school improvement work. We clarified that a teacher must be evaluated using the local teacher development and evaluation system to be identified as effective. I'll actually talk about this topic a couple times here because there were a couple different updates. One is this one, and then one is based on some feedback from the U.S. Department of Education that we received in December as well. So our ESSA plan required us to define kind of three key terms. First, ineffective. Out of field and inexperienced teachers. And this really was for the reason because states are required to look at low-income students, students of color, and American Indian students that are taught at disproportionate rates by ineffective teachers, inexperienced teachers, and out-of-field teachers, and then looking at gaps and setting forth strategies to address those gaps to make sure that all students have equitable access to experienced, qualified, and effective teachers. And so as we worked with stakeholders, we defined a teacher as an effective teacher if they are meeting local standards on their local teacher development and evaluation system. And so that was our definition that we had in our state plan, and as we came to you in the summer, that was the definition as well. But what we did clarify was that a teacher must be evaluated. So if you think about it, if you have to be meeting local teacher development and evaluation standards to be effective, well, then in order to do that, you have to be evaluated. So we just made that clarification that an effective teacher must also be evaluated. And then also, again, heard from our pre-K community that we want to include pre-K teachers in this as well. So so language around an effective pre-K teacher being a teacher that has the knowledge in early childhood curriculum content assessment, and then also focused on making sure those early childhood teachers have appropriate knowledge and skills and qualifications to meet the needs of English learners, too. Wei mentioned this, and so I'll pivot a little bit into our accountability kind of focus changes. Wei mentioned we heard really loud and clear a desire from stakeholders to align our state World's Best Workforce legislation and requirements with our federal ESSA plan. And there are multiple ways that we found opportunities to do this and some limitations in doing this as well. So as you may know, our state plan does include state goals that are aligned to the World's Best Workforce goals, in particular around closing achievement gaps, around third grade literacy, and around eighth grade math as kind of a proxy for career and college readiness. Not a perfect measure, but a proxy for career and college readiness. But one area that we do have more work to do is around school readiness. And we heard from stakeholders the desire to continue to explore the kindergarten entry profile as a potential option for a school readiness measure that could be included in our federal ESSA system as well. We know that the kindergarten entry profile is aligned to early childhood standards and kindergarten standards, but it's not required and not all districts participate in this. And so the limitation is that we don't have one school readiness assessment or measure that is standardized across the state, or comparable, I should say, not standardized, but comparable across the state in order to include that in our ESSA accountability system, or as a standard measure across the state for school readiness. So we clarified some language that we have more work to do in that area to better align with World's Best Workforce. We added that we will examine options and opportunities to use in-school suspension data as part of the consistent attendance indicator. And so consistent attendance is our framing of chronic absenteeism, right? We know that chronic absentees are more likely to be off track to graduate and off track academically. And so we've included this consistent attendance measure in our accountability system. And we heard from stakeholders the desire to continue to explore, can we look at in-school suspensions as students that are not in attendance? Right now, if a student receives a disciplinary incident and or disciplinary action and they get an in-school suspension, they're actually still counting as in attendance. And there was concern from stakeholders that maybe those students are not receiving instruction. They're being pulled out of the classroom. Maybe in some cases they are, but a desire to continue to explore this and really to incentivize positive disciplinary practices for kids. We included two additional types of schools that are eligible for support since we last talked. One is any school at what we call stage one, which would be any school that is in the Title I school, I should add, any Title I school in the bottom 25% for math achievement, reading achievement, or English language progress towards English language proficiency. So just focus on those three indicators. Any school that is low in math, reading, or English language proficiency would be eligible for support. And then secondly, any school, we did hear some uncertainty around using consistent attendance as sort of the decision maker and whether a school, the final decision maker, and whether a school is identified. And so we added a category of schools that will receive support through the regional centers if they're low in math achievement, reading achievement, English language proficiency, and then also math progress and reading progress, but maybe they had high enough consistent attendance to not be identified. And so this really goes back to making sure that we're identifying schools that are demonstrating low performance and low growth in math and reading as well. So we added that support category since we last talked too. A few changes kind of specific to our school improvement section of our state plan. First, we added some examples of potential additional interventions for schools that are re-identified. These would be schools that do not exit after 3 years their comprehensive support and improvement status. So, for example, if a school is identified in 2018 and then again is identified in 2020-21, 3 years later, what are we going to do to ensure that we're ramping up and intervening maybe at a more rigorous level with those schools that are re-identified. And so language in our state plan was added around conducting an on-site needs assessment that MDE would conduct in, along with the regional centers, that on-site needs assessment, but then provided some examples of the types of more rigorous interventions should be explored as a part of those schools that are re-identified, including potential for significant staffing changes, potential for leadership changes, potential for requiring specific student support services, all that tie back to this on-site needs assessment, and again, the needs that are established based on the collaboration between MDE and that school, but really making sure that there are some requirements around more rigorous supports and interventions for these schools. Secondly, we clarified that all schools identified for targeted support and improvement will assess and address resource inequities. This is a requirement in the federal law for our comprehensive support and improvement schools, but stakeholders wanted us to add this as a requirement for our targeted support and improvement schools. And those are schools that are identified based on student group performance, maybe not overall low performance, but specific student group performance. And addressing resource inequities could be looking at things like per pupil expenditures and obviously budgets. It also could be looking at equitable access to advanced coursework, or equitable access to, again, experienced teachers, right? And so thinking broadly about that word resource, right, from finances, but also to what opportunities and options and types of access do all kids have within that school and within that district. We added the role of school readiness data. I already mentioned that. And then data on disproportionate rates of suspension and expulsion as a part of the needs assessment process, two critical areas as we unpack needs and identify root causes and establish improvement plans with schools. I mentioned that our ESSA plan outlines multiple statewide goals around closing achievement gaps, around reaching high graduation rates. All of our goals focus on students overall and individual student groups as well. We did add one goal around English language development based on input from stakeholders since we last talked, and that is to have 85% of English learners making progress in achieving English language proficiency by the year 2025. Just for understanding sort of baseline or where we're at right now about 41.5% of English learners are making progress towards English language proficiency. And so you can see going from 41.5% to 85% is a high bar really demonstrates the need for some of the additional supports that I just talked about around making sure English learners are supported and advancing in their English language development. We added information on support for, and here's an example, on support for early care and early education teachers working with English learners. I had already mentioned that. So what I just talked about were all changes that were made based on the hearing we had with this committee, the 30-day public comment period, sort of leading up to that September submission. So now what I'll do is I'll pivot to clarifications that were made based on input and feedback from the U.S. Department of Education. So we submitted in September. We received our initial feedback on December 18th from the U.S. Department of Education. We did have a phone call with them on that day and then received a letter immediately after on that day as well, December 18th, outlining their feedback and their requests for clarifications. Overall, our feedback was really, really positive, and actually we heard a couple times that Minnesota had the shortest feedback letter. I haven't checked all of them, but I'll take that one at face value. So we really were pleased with our feedback and where we were at, and I think it was a demonstration of the significant work that we did with stakeholders that Wei talked about. So we were pleased with the initial feedback, but there were a couple areas that we had to think through and provide some clarification to the department, in addition to some really kind of more technical or, you know, spelling out acronyms, some of those kinds of things we had to do. But these were two of sort of the bigger clarifications. So one was clarifying exit criteria for comprehensive support and improvement schools. And so these are our lowest performing 5% of Title I schools. And the clarification that they asked for was making sure that those schools are demonstrating improvement based relative to their own performance. And so not just are those schools out of the bottom 5% based on how other schools are doing, but are they out of the bottom 5% to exit and showing improvement on the indicators that led to their identification. So if a school is identified for math achievement and math growth and consistent attendance, we want to make sure that that school is demonstrating improvement based on where they started in 2018 to where they are in 2021 in order to exit. Makes perfect sense to me. The second one is clarification around the reporting of disproportionate rates of students from low-income families, students of color, and American Indian students taught by, again, ineffective teachers. And I had mentioned that this was a requirement in ESSA for us to publicly report the disproportionate rates of students taught by ineffective, inexperienced, and out-of-field teachers. A few clarifications that we made here. One, we really went back to the World's Best Workforce Statute. And there is a requirement in the World's Best Workforce Statute that districts publicly report at a local level their equitable access data. And so we clarified in our ESSA state plan that all districts would publicly report the percentage of students, specifically percentage of students of color, American Indian students, and low-income students that are taught by ineffective teachers, again, going back to that local teacher development and evaluation system. So that's a requirement already, and so we wanted to clarify that in our ESSA plan, that all districts really should be doing this at the local level as a part of their annual report that is required to be posted to their website and their annual public meeting with their local stakeholders and their community. And so that was one clarification, that this public reporting is happening, should be happening at the local level, and that MDE can collect assurances of this. We don't collect the effectiveness data, but we can collect that this is publicly being reported by all districts in the state. Secondly, one piece of data that we know we do have some gaps around is student access to teachers with advanced degrees. And so at a state level, we can publicly report access of students of color, American Indian students, and low-income students to teachers with advanced degrees relative to their or compared to their counterparts. And so that is one piece of data that we will publicly report at the statewide level. And then the third clarification on this topic was around, again, citing state law, students cannot be taught by a teacher on an improvement plan for more than 2 years. It all connects, right, to this topic around equitable access to effective teachers. And so really relying back on some really strong state law that we have around this topic and providing that clarification to the federal department. Cannot be taught by a teacher on an improvement plan for 2 consecutive years. Right. Very good. Right. Thanks.
And we're holding questions till the end.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. And we received so we made these clarifications. We received our final approval on January 10th, just a little over a month ago.
Welcome, Mr. Keith. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, actually, I'm going to go through this because I know that we're kind of running short on time. So as I mentioned before, we really committed to our stakeholders that it wasn't going to be a one and done, that we weren't just going to submit the plan and just be done with it. We also committed to working with stakeholders on the school quality student success indicator or the consistent attendance. We know that people weren't fully happy with that as being the only indicator that we had, but based on the time, based on our data systems, that was what we could agree on at that time, and we committed that we would come back and have more discussions. So we developed 3 committees that have been meeting since December on, again, talking about the student success and school quality indicator, data reporting, and school recognition. And so we talked to stakeholders about what other measurements could we really use in our well-rounded
fifth indicator. And so we held three committees just to talk through, again, school readiness data, the KEP, for example, information that we have on college and career readiness, what kind of indicators could we use as part of our system. And throughout these conversations, again, I think the committee really struggled with unintended consequences that might arise if we were to include certain measurements in the system. For example, the KEP, as Stephanie mentioned, is not something that is statewide right now. It is not consistently used throughout the state. And so we really could not, until we are able to have that as a requirement and as have it fully funded to be used in our system. We also have conversations around college and career readiness, and really, is it fair for states, for schools around the state to be measured on something that they may not have funding for? They may not have teachers to be able to teach these courses. So there are just some inequities throughout the state, and are we really going to punish schools for not having the funding or the teachers with our teacher shortage? And so the final recommendation from the committee was to, at this point, keep consistent attendance as our indicator for the school quality and student success indicator. And again, a commitment to continue to have these discussions, continue to build out our data systems and seek changes, legislative changes and funding changes in order to include something else in the future. Data reporting, as I had mentioned too, that was not something that was required in our state plan, but it is something that is a major part of ESSA. By December 2018, we do have to report new data in our Minnesota reporting data system. So we are working with a committee right now. In addition to the committee, we have also held focus groups throughout the state, and we are taking invitations from organizations that would like to host focus groups. And in these meetings, what we're doing is we're looking at the current Minnesota report card and then comparing it also to other report cards in other states and getting a sense from stakeholders what they like and what they don't like, what kind of detail do they like, what kinds of details don't they like. And they've been really good, robust conversations. I think now with the information that we have, we really have to kind of think about what can we really deliver with the resources that we have right now. And so we actually will be meeting with them next week to start having those conversations. And in addition, we are also using an ideal scale. This is an online tool that allows people to generate ideas, comment on other people's ideas, and vote ideas on the reporting system. Again, trying to get a statewide input into our data systems. And then finally, the third committee is our school recognition committee. ESSA allows, this is the biggest area where we have flexibility in ESSA. It allows us to recognize schools, and it allows us to recognize schools however we want to recognize schools. So we are working with stakeholders on what they would like to see. And some of the themes so far that we have heard has been, let's not just focus on academics. Let's also not recognize schools that may be identified for support because they may actually have some areas where they're doing really, really well. So let's not just disqualify them from being recognized for something else. And I think with that, I'm going to turn it over to Greg because I know that we're running short on time.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Keith.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I am Greg Keith, Chief Academic Officer at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to come and tell you about our exciting work. I'm going to talk just a little bit about what we've been doing, update you on what we've been doing in the implementation of ESSA in a couple of different areas. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about communications. Now that we have an approved state plan, we want to be sure that we're communicating the contents of that plan and communicating around the work to districts, to schools, to communities, to families. We will be holding 7 regional meetings in April around the state with the goal of communicating to school and district leaders primarily the content of the weeds, the details of our accountability system, but also what would be school improvement requirements, what are priorities, how to align within their local World's Best Workforce work to the statewide World's Best Workforce and ESSA work. A big piece of the agenda will be conversations about equity and those 10 commitments that Wei shared earlier, and then sharing with them some resources and some strategies that they can use locally to communicate with families and with educators and with their communities around the state work and the state ESSA plan. We're also developing some resources. Our communications department is developing resources both that we can use, but primarily that local school districts can use to communicate with parents, to communicate with communities, to communicate with teachers, the contents of the ESSA plan and the changes that are coming under the implementation of the ESSA plan. We're really excited that they're developing some web modules as well that districts and schools can use to do presentations, to communicate locally around ESSA and around changes that are coming as a result of ESSA. One of the biggest areas where we've been doing a lot of work this school year, obviously the accountability and the continued stakeholder engagement there that Wei talked about, but we've really been doing a lot of work around school improvement. We started in the fall, even before plan submission, as we were finalizing the plan, we organized 8 different work groups around school improvement. I'm not going to read you the list, but I'll point out a couple of the more interesting ones. Under ESSA, we'll be doing a lot more work supporting high schools. As you know, we have to identify and support any high school with a graduation rate below 67% overall or for any student group. This will be about 150 high schools. And so we've been working on new tools and new processes and new supports for high schools, and specifically schools that serve credit and dropout recovery students. We know we need to provide a different level of support and differentiation for those schools or ALCs or charters. Another big difference in ESSA is the requirement around what schools and districts are implementing as part of school improvement, the level of rigor around what's the evidence base behind the strategies that they're implementing is ratcheted up under ESSA. And so one of the desires of stakeholders was that the state deliver and maintain a list, a non-exhaustive list, of evidence-based practices that schools and districts can choose from. So we've been doing a lot of work around developing a list of evidence-based practices in some specific areas, reading, math, chronic absenteeism, graduation rates, achievement gap, areas that we're measuring and that schools are looking at to measure their progress. We also think that that list will be useful to schools and districts in the World's Best Workforce work, so we're really working on this list as a tool for all schools and districts, but of course our primary audience is school improvement schools and districts. Finally, under ESSA, we've really been able to ratchet up our work around principal leadership and supporting principals, and I am going to elaborate a little bit about that. And then the fourth real area is under our waiver, the primary role for school improvement was the schools. And so the schools had a responsibility to improve. And our regional centers and our supports were delivered directly to schools. Districts, of course, played a role, but that role was not as formal. Under ESSA, under federal law, the primary responsibility for school improvement and for the school improvement work is placed on districts. And so we've had to reform how we deliver our supports directly to schools, and we've had to really define what's the role of the district in that work and how do we support districts to then support schools. So while we'll still be working directly with schools and on the ground in schools, we've really had to reform our theory of action and our supports to really also include supports for districts to then support schools. And we're really excited about that work. We've developed a pretty extensive resource to use with districts to help them define what's our role and what are some quick wins that we can do with schools to have some rapid change and rapid improvement. Said I was going to be short. Now I got so excited I'm talking a lot. So I'm going to try to be mindful of being short here. So some of the things that we've done specifically, we've added at three regional centers principal leadership specialists. We added that with the new Title II principal support money under ESSA. We've also added four graduation support specialists whose specialty area will be working with high schools and specifically designing systems to identify and support students at risk of not graduating in 4 years. And then we've added district support specialists at three regional centers. And I want to remind you that our specialists are all advocates, and they work directly with schools. They have a roster of schools that they're the point person for, that they're in, either for the continuous improvement schools, they're in weekly, working with those principals, working with those teachers, working with those leadership teams. And so they also wear the hat of a specialist to support other advocates in terms of, I'm a math specialist, and my school has a reading need. I can bring Stephanie, the reading specialist, over to the school. So they sort of have a cross-specialty group on the teams in the regional centers. I mentioned the evidence-based practices work. We're putting a lot of effort into supporting schools and districts in their work around addressing chronic absenteeism. This is a new piece that was not in our previous accountability system and supports. So we're putting a lot of effort into supporting schools and districts around chronic absenteeism. And then we're updating and redesigning our Minnesota Early Intervention and Response System. This is the system that helps schools identify students at risk of dropping out, high schools and middle schools, identify students at risk of not graduating in 4 years, and then supporting those students and reengaging and keeping those students engaged. So we're updating that system currently and actually are done with that. So we're beginning to communicate that to those changes out to schools and districts and train our advocates on that. I want to speak a little bit about the principal leadership supports. This is an area that we're really excited about, and especially the commissioner is really excited about and has said a few things about. We hired our principal leadership specialists in November and December, and they have really hit the ground running, have done a lot of work, have reached out to the professional associations. They've already started coaching and creating cohorts of principals for support. One of the things that they've done is they've researched seven different areas, and these are going to be their theory of action is to support principals in these seven different areas. These are research-based areas that effective principals demonstrate in their work and in their leadership, and so they've created some focus in terms of what they're going to do with principals and what characteristics and skills they want to develop in principals. And then they also surveyed sitting principals for information about what were their priorities and what were their needs. And so within that seven, you see the three that are bolded there are the ones that principals said, this is what we want you to help us with. And so a lot of work is going into those supporting principals and developing supports for principals in those three different areas, especially in the instructional feedback area. We've already started a program with the American Institute for Research around training principal supervisors to assist principals with providing meaningful instructional feedback to teachers through their teacher observation and teacher development and evaluation systems. So, Stephanie?
Great. Thank you, Greg. And what I'm going to do is just spend a couple minutes just talking about kind of as we pivot to implementation, the identification and the levels of support. You have the full table on slide 24, so I don't know that I need to go through all of it. We could dive deeper if you're interested at another time, but I'll just kind of touch on some of the levels of support, and then the second column includes all of the ways that schools are eligible for support through our system. So priority support and improvement is the highest level of support that schools and districts receive. These are schools identified for comprehensive support, and they're also in a district that is identified and receiving support through the world's best workforce legislation. So thinking about alignment of district-level identification, school-level identification, and providing our most targeted kind of intense support to those identified at that priority kind of top level. comprehensive support and improvement is this is ESSA terminology. Those are our lowest performing 5% of Title I schools on all indicators, and then also any public high school with a graduation rate below 67% overall or for any group. Greg mentioned that's approximately 150 schools or so receiving on-site assistance through our regional centers of excellence through that comprehensive support level. And then you can see the ways that schools are identified for targeted support. Primarily, this is based on student group performance. But targeted support is just below that comprehensive level. The support delivered through the regional centers of excellence, sort of the first point of contact, is with the district. A lot of the oversight and resourcing and implementation of improvement plans is at the district level, with our regional center staff providing assistance to the district. So that's the targeted support. The targeted support level. And then lastly, I had mentioned one of the additional school identifications were Title I schools performing low on math achievement, reading achievement, or English language proficiency at stage one. And this would be kind of the lowest level of support received, not necessarily through the regional centers, but through technical assistance, professional development, and networking opportunities really facilitated by our staff across the agency at the Minnesota Department of Education. And so those are the levels of support and each of the identifications there as well. And just to give you an update on timeline, as we move to the 18-19 school year, which is our first year implementing our new accountability and support system, August 30th is our target date for publicly releasing assessment and accountability results. So on August 30th, we will have all of our test results in math, reading, and science publicly available, as well as all of the new ESSA accountability indicators and ESSA school and district identifications available publicly on that day, too. And we'll move into the 18-19 school year, which is when the support begins.
And also in August, World's Best Workforce. So we will right. be formally identifying districts under World's Best Workforce for support. So that lines up
right.
In terms of timelines. Just very quickly, even though, as Stephanie said, we won't do formal identifications until August, high school graduation rates for last year are released next week, so we will have the graduation data that we need to project what will be the high schools, charter schools, ALCs that are identified or will be identified for comprehensive support improvement. We want to hit the ground running since we've got that information, and so we already have a communication drafted so that as graduation results come out next week, we can go ahead and reach out to those districts and schools and say, we have the data. You're going to be identified in August. Let's roll up our sleeves. Let's get started now. Why wait until August? And so we have some introductory, what we're calling kickoff meetings in March with those schools. Advocates are already being assigned to those schools so that they can start that on-site work around needs assessment and starting to put together a plan. We already have day-to-days scheduled in June to work with those schools and their leadership teams. And then also we've already scheduled and developed training around MERS or the revised MERS. We haven't come up with our formal name for that yet. Grad track is what we're leaning towards right now. Also, we've run some preliminary World's Best Workforce data, and we have a list of districts that we think are probably very likely to be identified, even though we don't have the MCA and the results for 2018. As we run them through the accountability system, we have a list of districts and charters that will very likely be identified in the fall. And so, as you know, we provide feedback on district summaries every year in March, and then as follow-up to that, we're going to go ahead and reach out to those districts and charters, have a conversation about the likelihood of them being identified in August so that we can also start to do some work with them. And we're establishing cross-functional teams at MDE to work with those World's Best Workforce districts and collaborate with the regional centers around supporting those districts and the schools within those districts. So we're trying to get ahead of the school improvement game by doing what we can with the data that we have prior to August. Just one quick thing. We've put together a year one school improvement timeline. So some of the things that you could expect schools to really be working on with their districts and with the regional centers in year one after August would be establishing a school leadership team, conducting their needs assessment, looking at resource inequities, putting together their school improvement plan, getting that plan approved by the school district state. We also have another track of work, and then installing what they need to install for the 2 years of implementation that follow. Another track that they'll work on next school year is we've identified some what we're calling quick win strategies, some things that they can leverage for some immediate improvements, some immediate victories and celebrations to impact student learning and teaching. While they're putting together their school leadership team and their plan. So this will be something that we're really excited about, these quick wins. We've identified five different areas in which they'll be working on quick wins in year one. So with that being said, thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. And I think, members, you can tell from this presentation that they did exhaustive work in preparing this. And now the big stuff is ahead, called implementation. And that's going to be really critical. We have some questions before we move on to special education. But my question is to any one of you at the table, how interested or what kind of excitement or otherwise are you hearing from districts now that we're ready to launch this for next school year? Is there anxiety? Is there excitement? Can you share any of that? Because, you know, that's really where it's going to happen. You're going to be the support system, but they have to do the implementation. So any comfort you can provide us, and I don't know if there's anyone in the audience who's going to give me a nod, but Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I think that we've received pretty good feedback from the school superintendents and stakeholders about the process. I do think that there's some anxiety still about implementing any new system.
Yes.
I think that they were heartened that it wasn't a full overhaul from our waiver. Many of our districts are working on the world's best workforce plans. They're glad that that's aligned and that they're glad that we're continuing to look at ways to continue to align it even better into one kind of overall strategic plan. But I do think that they're still really nervous. And I think the nervousness comes a little bit more with the world's best workforce because of the identification of the district and yes. The set-asides of the 2% as well as the integration revenue now and closing of achievement gaps. And many of our school districts, you know, are just starting this work around equity and cultural competence, training, working with their community and their stakeholders in really different ways, and those systems are still yet maturing. And so I think it's work that they want to do, as we could have evidence through our AMSD and our Metro partners who are doing the Reimagine Minnesota and some of the other core work that we're seeing our rural superintendents doing within their regional co-ops. So I think that they're really digging in on this equity work, and they're starting to put in practices. We've moved beyond awareness, I think, which is really encouraging, and I feel very proud of our schools with this. But I do think yet there's still a lot more anti-racism work to be done, looking at, you know, fees and lunch policies and all other kinds of barriers that are in front of our children to create better opportunities. So they're excited, but they're also saying anxious.
Thank you, Commissioner. Let's move to some member questions. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And will you reference, you know, which area you would like to?
I'll try to.
Zero in. Thank you.
In the presentation from Ms. Graff, just real briefly, when you were talking about students being taught by ineffective teachers, does that connect with you? And 2 years in a row? I just wanted to hear more about that portion of it, how... More detail about it?
Sure.
Ms. Graff?
Absolutely, sure. So, Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, so ESSA does require us to look at, and actually World's Best Workforce mirrors this requirement. So it's both in federal law and it's in the World's Best Workforce 120B.11 statute as well, to ensure that districts are examining their data and setting forth strategies around ensuring low-income students, Students of color and American Indian students have equitable access to effective and in-field and experienced teachers. And so providing support to districts in taking a look at their local data, which students have access within which classrooms to effective teachers, and which students have access within which classrooms and which programs to experienced teachers. When we look at the data at a statewide level, we know that our students of color and our American Indian and low-income students are much more likely to be taught by teachers that are not within their license area and are within their first 3 years of teaching. And so so really focusing on making sure, and this is this is an equity issue, right? So making sure that we're providing support to districts in peeling back, taking a look at their data, peeling back the layers, getting to the root cause, and setting forth strategies to close those gaps so all students have access to qualified, effective teachers. So within the ESSA plan, if you're specifically talking about the effective piece, mm-hmm. We worked with stakeholders to define an effective teacher as a teacher that is meeting local teacher development and evaluation standards. Mm-hmm. So we don't collect that data at a state level, but this is reported at a local level through the World's Best Workforce. And so districts are to report percentage of students that are being taught by ineffective teachers, and particularly looking at students of color, American Indian students, and low-income students relative to their counterparts.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pryor.
Thank you. And one concern that I have, or something that I'd like to understand, is there's two different things. One is when you've been evaluated and you have that record, but then you have the other thing, which is the first-year student or first-year teacher. And so if you're just starting out teacher, and if you're a student that keeps getting a teacher that is in their first year of teaching, then you won't be caught. You know, you could still be having an ineffective teacher year after year. So how is this data brought together for school districts to, you know, so that we can make sure that this is not happening to our students?
Well, there's certainly going to be a lot more emphasis on the role of the principal, mm-hmm. and so I'm glad that in the ESSA plan you've put a great emphasis on principal leadership. And thank you, Mr. Keith, for leading that charge, and Ms. Graff as well.
Madam Chair.
But Commissioner, would you like to respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, I'd just like to also add that, you know, this is, I think, why St. Paul Public Schools put in their contract looking at Tier 1 and Tier 2 teachers in anticipation of the federal law. I think that they're going to have to prove that there's effective teachers, and that it's really around the assignment of the teachers within a district. We don't have any power over that as a state entity. However, school principals will be better instructional leaders through the training. They'll be able to provide better professional development to teachers. And, you know, before that used to be community experts, but now there will be Tier 1 and Tier 2. That's why evaluation is such an important piece at the local level. They'll be collecting this information and providing us assurances. But I think school districts now recognize that they may need to get ahead of this in lieu of having teacher shortages, whether it's a substitute teacher or a community expert or a Tier 1 teacher or whatever type of system we have, to ensure that the way that you assign students is that they don't get, you know, teachers who are substitutes or are not qualified in their area to teach it when you are in a disproportionately high minority, high poverty school.
Representative Pryor, anything else?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
You know, we're going to have to chew on all of this. Right. Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, may I offer? Just to be really explicit, the requirement around students not having a teacher who is not meeting expectations under teacher evaluation is also in our state law.
Yeah, it's in statute.
It's in the teacher evaluation and development statute. So, yeah. So that was something we just pulled from state law.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. The first one is really a broad overall question, and it goes to the issue of resources and not just money in terms of thinking about this, but it seems to me that, and thank you for the presentation. I know we barely scratched the surface with it. You know, it seems that Minnesota has a real rich, comprehensive policy frame that helps schools be better. We've been at this for quite a while, and I would say, Madam Chair, I think we ought to take a little credit for actually getting out ahead of the federal government and the ESSA requirements and frame, if you will. Obviously, the world's best workforce, I believe, really took a very bold step forward. I like to think that the feds were influenced, by our work here. But now we've got this, hopefully what will become a tightly knit world's best workforce ESSA policy frame. And then it's in Minnesota, we complement that with sort of not lesser, but, kind of next level, I would argue, policy frames that you'll find like in the LEAPS Act and our Achievement and Integration in Minnesota Act. All of which point to many of these same expectations and interventions, accountability, transparency, et cetera, requirements. So my question very broadly is, and I know we're not the money committee, but let me just ask this. Does the department have sufficient resources to implement this rich policy frame? And specifically, so I'm not looking for quantitative, specifically, what one thing could the department better resource or pursue? And there's several, I suspect. But what one thing, particularly for this policy committee, should we be thinking about in terms of continuing to partner with our executive branch to be able to up the game, up the effort, up the ability of the department to be that helpful presence for our schools and school districts?
Commissioner? Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, it's a very good question. We do have some new flexibilities with our federal funding that we've been able to use, hold back 7% of that in order to do school improvement activities. Most of that money goes out to our regional centers and cooperatives, and we've been doing things like equity specialists, principal specialists out in our regional centers now, as well as those that we had previously, EL specialists, specialists in special ed, reading and math. And so they work as a team out in the field supporting schools around school improvement and school turnaround, which is really important work. Then we have staff at the agency, and the way that I've restructured our executive team with Stephanie as a chief accountability officer, Greg as chief academic officer, overseeing federal programs and overseeing our school support work so that it's integrated across functions within the department. We need more folks at the department, though, to provide that kind of leadership and convening of the experts out in the field so that we have a statewide strategy and not siloed strategies where we see one regional center of excellence really being able to capture and provide resources to a community where another community can't. So we want to be able to step in and fill that gap. So there's additional resource at the department on our academic side, as well as really trying to ramp up our regional centers. They can always use more resources out in the regional centers and more experts. Remember, those are locally hired folks that have good credibility within those regions working with teachers and along teachers at the school site. They're not physical locations for new members here. Just want to make sure people don't think that we expect schools to come to us. We actually go out and do this work, and Greg and the partnership with all of our cooperatives and the regional centers do just excellent work supporting schools. So more resources we think would help us move forward even faster. But I think as we move into the accountability measures of world's best workforce, money may be less of a factor as schools look to provide and purchase services that they value. And what we've heard from our field is that they very much value the regional center work. And actually, we have people asking us can the regional centers help us? And they feel over capacity because they're not able to help those that aren't federally funded. And so we want to make sure that they have that opportunity to do so. And now with World's Best Workforce, because it's not just Title I schools that are under the World's Best Workforce, it's all of our schools in Minnesota. So if you're identified as a district, you can use some of your set-asides, either in integration funding or in your World's Best Workforce funding, to support having that expertise. And that would help our cooperatives expand and grow and provide even a more robust regional support system.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I like the way you frame that in terms of the department going out to schools. It seems to me that's probably a bigger challenge and perhaps a bigger need in greater Minnesota than in regional centers and or the Twin Cities, where you've got much larger school districts, which arguably have much more infrastructure to be able to aggressively pursue some of these accountability expectations. I want to switch very quickly.
Representative Mariani, before you go to that,
yes, please.
Could Greg Keith talk a little bit about our metro focus and how that's very different than how we do our regional centers out in rural Minnesota? If you could just speak to kind of how we support Minneapolis-St. Paul in the metro.
Mr. Keith.
It's unique in that it's not similar to working with the cooperatives out in the field.
Madam Chair, we, as you know, we have six regional centers throughout Minnesota. Rochester, Marshall, Sartell, Fergus Falls, Thief River Falls, and Mountain Iron. And even these are places that employ the advocates. Really, their offices are their cars. They, you know, drive to schools and they spend their time in schools. For Minneapolis and St. Paul, we know that they have also a large number of schools that we're supporting and are required to support. We work with them a little bit differently. Under ESSA, a state education agency can directly fund districts that have the capacity to support schools and also have a significant number of schools identified for support. And so with Minneapolis and St. Paul, we work not through the regional centers, but directly with Minneapolis and St. Paul. We provide funding directly to them. And they have their own teams of advocates and specialists. They do use a lot of the same resources as the regional centers. They attend training with the advocates from regional centers. And we have a project manager specifically at MDE who works directly with Minneapolis and St. Paul to coordinate their supports. So we work more directly with those two districts versus through the regional centers. But the support on the ground at the schools is very similar. We share a theory of action. As I said, we share a lot of resources and some consistent training across the people who are in the schools. But they also have teams that work in the schools. But they directly coordinate their own supports with our assistance.
And that's been fairly recent that they've worked with the State Department that collaboratively.
Follow-up, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, it's very helpful. Madam Chair, for the sake of time, I'll yield my time because I know others have questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the Commissioner and the assistants for a really comprehensive and inspiring report. It makes me feel really good that lots of good things are happening in the schools. And if I may, because this material was also provided to us, summary of 2018 legislative reports on, pages aren't numbered. But the
Representative Ward, we're going to move that report to Thursday.
Okay.
So if next week, okay. Yes, a week from today, because, you know, this is very intense. I think you all realize this.
It's deep.
What we're putting the testifiers, the pressure we're putting on them in this presentation and then for us to absorb it. You know, as a former teacher, I know the intensity that occurs, and so I whispered to my committee administrator, we can't, you know, just do all of this today. We overplanned. But we'll move that report. So if that question is not exactly relevant, you can ask it in a week.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll wait till next week.
Thank you very much. So the schedule a week from today will be that summary report, and we've already checked with the department, and they are available. So sorry that you had to come over here and spend this time, but we appreciate you. So are there other questions for our presenters? Representative Mariani, you can have the last question.
Thank you. I might as well jump back in. So this question is a much more specific question related to the information shared on page 17 and 18, data reporting system. So the issue here is the question of what indicators to include in a data reporting system and how to present that to families and communities. And to do that for the overall data reporting of our schools, plus also identifying successful schools as well. So I presume so that we can learn, right? We can share with one another. So a couple of quick questions. One is, I thought that the federal ESSA required a plan to identify a particular reporting system. Am I incorrect about that, or do we have time to do that, or is this like an evolving thing in terms of our relationship with the ESSA plan, or am I confusing two things here?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I'll let Waze speak to technical pieces of a reporting system and what's required and where her group's at now in terms of what they're asking us for. But you are correct. It has to be in place by the 18-19 school year. So they're not specific in, you know, whether that means at the beginning of the 18-19 school year or sometime during it. Our goal is to get this out as soon as possible. We want to make sure that teachers have the tools they need to be able to affect change and to do good planning, and then also that parents have good information as well. So in plain language type of usable form so that they can advocate for their schools. Another piece that we haven't talked about is fiscal transparency, which is also going to be required. And so part of ESSA is fiscal transparency. Tom Melcher and his team is currently working on that design and thinking through what's already reported, what data systems are reporting. As you know, our funding systems are quite complex in Minnesota in terms of how we fund schools with levies and local and state and federal dollars. And it gets to be challenging, and we're trying to figure out how do we get that information in parents' hands, in the public's hands, in a way that's digestible and easy to read and understand, especially all the specific categorical aids that we have in Minnesota to fund our equity agenda. You know, American Indian Education revenue, revenue for EL learners, compensatory revenue for poor kids, integration of revenue specifically targeting achievement gap in integrated schools. So we have a number of funding systems in Minnesota in order to really affect our equity agenda, which is very unique. And we're ranked number one and number two by the Ed Trust in how we fund our schools equitably. So it's nice not to be at the bottom of a list on that funding. But I'll let Wei talk a little bit about where the committee is now and what's required in our reporting.
Ms. Nguyen.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, we are going to share this information with the committee next week. So those committee members are getting firsthand information. As we did with our ESSA planning, we have a short-term plan and a long-term plan. So as Stephanie Graff mentioned, the accountability and assessment information will be available in August. We will be identifying schools in August. And we want to make sure that when we release the information, we have that information on our school report card so that students and parents, the community, can see. So for the short term, we will be updating our current Minnesota report card to properly display the new assessment and accountability. We will continue to work with stakeholders to develop the new Minnesota report card with what they have told us that they want to see. The law says that new data reporting data needs to be on the report card by December 2018. So again, depending on resources, depending on availability of IT, or if we go and contract out, we may have to put the new data on, again, the current Minnesota report card in December. But again, also with the long term plan of overhauling our report card. So you may see this kind of happening in stages.
And Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, Madam Chair, we think that it's going to cost somewhere about $1 million, $1.5 million to really have a robust kind of report card that the community is telling us that they want, the kind that other states have. But we just don't have the resources to build out a data system that would give us what other states currently have. And so we're forced, because of lack of resources, to just update our current report card. Currently, if the legislature comes through with more funding for this project, then we would certainly work with Minnesota IT to develop this system or go out for RFP for one that, you know, maybe is a vendor that other states have have used that the stakeholder group is saying, oh, let's do this one because it's really good or similar type of system.
So, Commissioner, the dashboard or Commissioner Way, the dashboard fits into this as part of the total reporting system. Could you comment on that briefly?
Madam Chair, that is correct. You know, what we have also struggled with is we keep interchanging Minnesota report card and dashboard and whatnot. So we're trying to be consistent with our terminology. And so just internally at MDE, we're saying CURT Minnesota report card. What's the other one? Revised Minnesota report card, which is what you would see in, updated Minnesota report card, which is what you would see in August, and then new Minnesota report card, which is the vision that the stakeholders are telling us is what they want.
Thank you. Representative Marion.
Madam Chair, on that point, and thank you, Madam Chair, for because I do that a lot, too. I confuse the two or three, whatever they are.
Yes.
And I have heard out in the field some expectations that we on this side of the table be the ones that do that designing. And I'm not committed to doing that, as flattered as I may be by the suggestion, because I want to get it right. And it sounds to me like the department is going through a pretty deliberative process in order to do that. And I, Madam Chair, I guess I just want to encourage us to be very mindful of that as others come forward and expect us, as they should, you know, to think about this and perhaps weigh in on this. I think the key is going to be, and I think with this side of the table, we'll be looking at the executive branch, will be to ensure that all the proper stakeholders are fully engaged and participating in your role, in your design, and in your eventual rollout for this.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I think the biggest really contentious piece has been just about the summative rating.
Yes.
I think that there's a general sense out there by the community that they want to have a summative rating because they think it's easier for parents and the community to understand. We've committed to some sort of summative type of rating, and so I think, you know, we just listen to stakeholders and try to figure that all out together. We can figure out something that's good for kids, that works, and that's evidence-based, and is going to move the agenda forward for schools so that teachers have the information they need and parents have the information they need.
And Representative Mariani and members, we will be hearing a bill in regard to a summative rating system. Representative Ross Peterson is hearing that, so we'll look forward to that in the future. Thank you very much, team from MDE. Commissioner, again, thank you, and to all. We're going to turn to special education update now, and I'm sorry such an important topic is going to be the end of the meeting, but we need to get an update on this, too, since this is such an essential part of the education of our children. Welcome to the table, and Mr. Cordy, please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, Darren Cordy with the Minnesota Department of Education Assistant Commissioner. I'm actually going to have Assistant Commissioner Nguyen address the first couple slides, and then I'll jump in.
Thank you. Representative Nguyen, or I should say Commissioner Nguyen, begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, we are going to be providing you an update. It's our understanding that you wanted an update on our regional approaches to how we deliver special education services and professional development out into the field. So one of the divisions I oversee is early learning, and our early learning special education team resides within our early learning team. So I will take that section. And then Assistant Commissioner Cordy will take the special education and then the paperwork reduction slides. So beginning in 2009 with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Funds, we used early special education funds, Part B and Part C, to provide a regional approach of professional development to school districts. And we just want to make sure that people around the table understand that this work is separate from the work of the regional centers. It is a regional approach to delivering services, but they are not actually working through the regional centers that Mr. Greg Keith discussed earlier. So the mission of this project is to improve the outcomes for young children with disabilities and their families by providing those professionals working with them with the tools and knowledge that they need to work with this this specific population. We provide support to all school districts, and we help them evaluate their needs. Again, unlike the regional centers, it is available to all districts. And then we work with any district who volunteers to work with us to work more specifically and in-depth in certain innovative areas, such as working with home visitors and how do they work with families in the home setting. We also work on the pyramid model, which is, again, it's professional development with special education teachers, and then we also work with teachers in the classroom as how do they integrate early education, special education with the regular education classrooms as well. We are currently working with about 49 districts in these three different innovation areas. And last year we trained a little over 750 educators in the professional development area.
Mr. Cardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Minnesota Regional Low Incidence Projects that we fund through the Department of Education. These are projects that help serve school districts and charter schools in the implementation of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, provide professional development, on-site technical assistance, and consultation in what we call priority low-incidence disabilities. So when we talk about low-incidence disabilities, these are really just disabilities that we find that are relatively rare occurring in our student population. And this can pose significant challenges to school districts, particularly small ones. So if you have a student with one of these low-incidence disabilities come into your district, you may not have the capability or services or resources to provide the services that that student needs. And as we know, you know, we can't turn students away because we don't have capacity to serve them, so districts have to figure out a way to get those services. And one of the ways that we help facilitate that is through these regional low-incidence projects. These are statewide projects that are organized regionally, so there's regional entities that oversee these projects. Some of them are housed within the local regional service cooperatives. Some of them are housed within actual school districts. But they hire a regional low-incidence facilitator who, when a student with a low-incidence disability comes into a district, that district may not have the capacity to serve, then that facilitator will marshal resources from other parts of the region or other parts of the state to help serve that student. So it could look like finding somebody to contract for services that could be educational services or other services such as audiology, interpreting, or health-related services as well. It could look like assistive technology. So if you have one district that may have had some technology that they were using for a student with a low-incidence disability, they don't need that technology anymore, then they can transfer it over to another district that might have that, and the facilitator would help cooperate that.
Members, we'll hear more on assistive technology a week from today when we review that report.
Absolutely. So, again, it's funded through IDEA federal discretionary funds to the tune of about $4 million per year. And we hear great things from the field about these projects, that it saves time, it saves money, and it ultimately gets services out to students faster. And you'll see here that it's statewide projects and that it's organized by the governor's economic development regions. So we do have statewide coverage on this project.
And that was a very good way to organize it, by the way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also wanted to give an update on our efforts to reduce special education paperwork requirements. We did give a more in-depth presentation on this last session, but just to refresh your memories, we do several trainings around the state that help give districts clear expectations about what the federal and state requirements are around special education documentation. One of the things that we have heard from the field is that there may be local requirements that are in excess of state and federal requirements that are creating additional paperwork. So we do provide these trainings to make it clear what the state requires and what the federal what the federal government requires, and then if there are additional requirements that, a local district wants to put in place and they see value in that, they certainly can, but that's not something that's going to be required by us. So we have the Special Education 101, which provides a comprehensive hands-on approach to special education process for direct service providers. And again, with that focus of being clear what the expectations are in state and federal laws. We had 10 trainings. We have 10 trainings that will be taking place over the 17-18 school year. And we have a number of other trainings that are listed there. I won't go through them in depth with you in interest of time, but in the last year we had 35 different sessions across all those areas with over 1,500 participants. So it is something that we get a lot of interest across the state on. And we also have several online trainings that can be accessed at any time through our website, and these are modules that have been created and used often by special education teachers in the field. We talked last year about changes to program monitoring that we put in place. Several of the paperwork requirements are either in state or federal law, so we don't necessarily have control over that, but one area that we do have control over is how we do monitoring of districts with their compliance with the federal and state education laws. One thing that we did to kind of ease the burden on districts in that monitoring process was we moved from a 5-year to a 6-year review cycle. So that gives districts an extra year to kind of catch their breath and make sure that they're providing the services and have the systems in place that they're needing to provide efficient services for students with a disability. We reduced the number of items that we monitor, the number of documents that districts are required to produce that we actually go through and take a look at by about 30%. And the importance of that is the fewer documents that we're reviewing, that means the fewer citations that we're going to find and the fewer things that are going to require corrective action by the district. And that corrective action is typically done by teachers. Then they have to go back and fix documents when we find that there are areas of noncompliance. So the fewer times that there's the corrective action, that there's less time for teachers to spend just correcting that paperwork. And you might ask, you know, well, isn't that providing if we're not finding those citations there, isn't that not giving the due process and safeguards to students? Well, we also still, of course, have the complaint process on the back end. So if a parent feels like they're not receiving the services that their student is entitled to, then they can always file a complaint and corrective action can be issued that way. We did consult with MACE, the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, and the Education Minnesota Special Education Unit in doing this work. One of the other areas that we've talked about with the field, and particularly MACE, was around functional behavioral assessments. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a bit of a difference in interpretation of the federal law about when a functional behavioral assessment is required. For those of you who aren't familiar, functional behavioral assessment is a tool that's used to kind of determine why a student is behaving a certain way. It's a number of techniques that get behind why a student or where a student's inappropriate behavior is coming from. So one of the ways that we are attempting to deal with that difference of opinion kind of in the field is that we pulled together a cross-division work group within our agency and then brought in external stakeholders to address those questions that were coming from our directors. And we've developed a visual guide that's going to help be clear about what the expectations are, again, about when a functional behavioral assessment is needed. And we're reviewing a template that will be used when we do training for special education administrators and direct service providers. Again, just making sure that the expectations are clear, that there's not extra work being done that doesn't need to be done, but that the requirements under the state and federal law are being met. So, Madam Chair, I'll be happy to take any questions you have around that.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. Are there any questions from members in regard to special education? Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, this is probably an unfair question, but I'll throw it out there just to see where it might take me. What connection, what correlation are you willing to share relative to the impact of these efforts on the cost drivers in the broader special ed field? Or should we be expecting changes to rising costs in special ed as a result?
Commissioner.
Well, I'll take that one. Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, yes, we have rising incidences of special ed, of students needing special ed services. Therefore, we have also rising incidence of costs of covering special ed. And as you know, and we'll discuss probably in the Finance Committee quite in depth, that we fall short. The federal government falls short. But as a state, we also fall short in funding the full needs of our students with disabilities, and therefore school districts have what's called a cross-subsidy. For new members, sometimes that's hard to understand, but it's really just generally if you give $1,000 for a general ed student and it costs $300 more to pay for the services for a student with disabilities, then that comes off the top of all the students in the general ed fund. And so, you know, for everyone's benefit within a district, it pays to invest in fully funding our special education.
Representative Mariani,
follow-up? Madam Chair, it's more a comment, I guess, in follow-up. I think, you know, this has kind of been, you know, part of the Holy Grail search for us for years, yeah. Right? And I think it sounds to me like your approach is a smart one because it politically has to be a smart one. And that is, you've got to make sure that you're engaging folks who are advocates in the field, in this area, because I think that's where we've gotten into trouble lots of times in the past. Mm-hmm. Mr. Cordy alluded quickly to, you know, raising the question that was in all our thoughts, mm-hmm. you know, which is, so does that mean that we're not taking care of the kids then as a result of this effort, you know, to partly address this issue through paperwork. I suspect that we'll hear from advocates some concern with that, mm-hmm. but the fact that you've got them at the table to be part of the solution, I think, really takes us a long way. It certainly helps us on this side of the table because we'll get pressure from all sides, you know, in trying to make the difficult decision of making sure that needs are being met at the same time that we're able to properly resource special ed in our schools. Mm-hmm. So I was going to ask you to quantify what that expert, but I think I won't do that. Maybe I'll do that in finance.
Thank you.
We can get you that information.
Thank you again, staff and commissioners from MDE, for spending all of this time with us today. Much appreciated, especially for a DFL lead and a chair. We're the ones who really have to try to understand this, but members, this has been very good. So thank you very much. Members, would you pull out your minutes, please, from April 4, 2017, and look them over. And Representative Daniels, when you have examined them, would you move approval?
I actually examined them before we started, so I do approve the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Daniels moves approval of the minutes from April 4, 2017. Are there any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Members, I would really like you to take this work that MDE did in this PowerPoint and put it in your save file. And then to put in your file for today's meeting the materials we did not cover today, which would be the handout called Summary of 2018 Legislative Reports and the House File 2737. There will be additions made, of course, for next Tuesday, because Tuesday we will hear the sexual exploitation bill, sex trafficking that Representative Jessup and Representative Pryor have worked on. We're going to have students in testifying. They have really led the charge on this. I believe they're from your area, Representative Pryor. So that's going to be our main goal on Tuesday, is to hear that bill, hear from testifiers, and lay that over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And then we might have some add-ons. But that will be the additions made. But to help the pages, let's not create more recycling. So recycling today should be the agenda and the minutes. That should be the only two pieces of paper, unless you had other stuff you brought that we leave for recycling. Is there any other business to come before this committee? If not, the meeting is adjourned.